Would you join me by opening your Bibles to 1 Peter chapter 3? It might surprise you to hear this, but it's been a little bit more than a month and a half now since Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico, the Caribbean, parts of Florida, and left thousands and thousands of homes without power. And like many of you, we have family and friends in that area of the country. And I was actually talking to one of my cousins once about hurricanes down in Florida. And he told me, you know, the rest of the world kind of freaks out at these things, but for us, it's just a part of living here. He said, if you go to Kansas, they're so used to tornadoes, they don't even blink unless they're real serious. The same thing for hurricanes, that for them in that part of the country, that's just part of life. He said, but they do have emergency plans in place. The news will have instructions as to what to do. But he also told me that usually these hurricanes turn out to be nothing more than really a bad thunderstorm. And in the 20 years he's lived in Orlando, he told me that he has only ever been evacuated 2 times. And both of those times, it was almost a false alarm because he came home and there was no damage. All of that changed, however, this year in September when Hurricane Maria struck, and my cousin was actually at home alone when this happened. You see, he works for the emergency management services of his township, and they told them to be on hand in case of an emergency. So my cousin's family all evacuated. They went to another part of the state away from the storm. My cousin stayed. But the plan was all the employees would kind of shelter in place there at their command center. Only when it came to the day of the storm, they realized they had too many people. And so they had to send some home. One of those was my cousin. So he ended up in his house by himself when this storm struck. And he decided he would chronicle this storm through video messages that he put out on Facebook. And the very first message I'll remember, he said, you know what, it's a hurricane, we've had them before, life is going to go on after this, and so I've got my batteries, I've got my food, I've got my water, I'm ready to go. And the very last video he submitted through that storm, he said, look, the power is out. There's a crack developing in my ceiling. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm scared. It turned out he was fine, but he did admit it was the scariest storm he had ever been in his entire life. But he also said that knowing what to do, being prepared, having a step-by-step process of getting ready sure helped him a lot. You see, storms will happen. It isn't a matter of if, it's a matter of when. They will happen. You live on this world, you live in this society, you are a human being. You will go through storms in life. And spiritually, you will also go through storms in life. In fact, later on in this letter, Peter says in chapter 4, beloved, don't be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you, as though something strange were happening. Spiritual storms are a part of being a believer in the world. You will have people try and make life harder because of your faith. They will come against you at all areas they possibly can. And sometimes those storms will come out of a place you least expected. It would be a friend that has been your friend your whole life, or a family member that you've trusted your whole life, and then one day, for no apparent reason, it seems that they've turned. It could be a storm that comes out of something that you thought was a minor little issue. And before you know it, it has blown up into a Category 5 hurricane. Storms will come and they'll catch us off guard. And being ready and knowing what to do and having a step-by-step process will help any believer. It was C.S. Lewis who very famously was asked, why do Christians suffer? And his answer was, because they're the only ones who can take it. And there's some truth in that. And that's what Peter's getting at as we close chapter 3. What do we do in the midst of a storm? Not what do we do in case a storm happens, but how do we respond when it's actually occurring? When we're standing in the midst of the storm itself, when we're actually dealing with the difficulty, what does a believer do in the moment? How do we respond? Well, as we read through this passage this morning, there's a few things we notice Peter tells us to do. And the first thing is to seek high ground. Now, that doesn't mean to go outside and go run up a hill, but moral ground. Be the bigger person. Take the high road. Notice what he says in verse 8. Finally, all of you, having unity of mind, sympathy, brotherly love, a tender heart, and a humble mind. Do not repay evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, bless. For to this you were called, that you may obtain a blessing. You know, there's an old saying, don't get mad, get even. That's right, I heard somebody say it. And that's the motto of the world, is it not? The world would say that if somebody's come against you, if somebody's injured you in some way, don't just move on with your life. The world would say, get back at them, get even, take them to court, sue them for all they're worth. That's the attitude of the world. And if you want an example, all you have to do is turn on your TV during any daytime block, and you'll see one of the dozens of courtroom TV shows where so-and-so is suing so-and-so because of something. That's the attitude of the world. And actually, I read this past week that every year in the United States, more than $239 billion is paid out because of civil litigation. Now, that doesn't mean don't ever go to court. That's not to say it's always wrong to go to court. I think we need to be careful about that. I think the Bible has a lot to say about believers going to court, especially when it's another believer you're involved with. But when we have $250 billion awarded every year in civil judgment, $800 per person in our nation alone, we have a problem. You might be interested to know, that's something other parts of the world think is very odd. When a tourist comes from another country, one of the strangest things they see is that we allow our lawyers to advertise their civil services. They say in other parts of the world, in other nations, that's not allowed because it encourages in their mind frivolous litigation, and some even call it courtroom vengeance. But that's the way of the world in which we lived. But we're not called to be of the world, even though we're in the world. You and I, as believers, are called to a higher ground. We're called to take the high road, to be the bigger person, to be better than that. Jesus said in Matthew 5, blessed are the merciful. Not blessed are those with the best attorney, but blessed are the merciful. Later on in the chapter, he says, you've heard it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your shirt, give him your coat also. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. And here Peter says in verse 9, do not repay evil for evil or reviling for reviling. Take the high ground. Be better than that. There's a story of a farmer who kept getting robbed. Somebody was breaking into his barn about every single month and taking tools and taking supplies. And the police were pretty sure this was the same guy. It was the same MO. He came in the same way. He stole the same sorts of things, only they could never catch him. Well, the farmer couldn't afford it, as you might imagine, and so he took matters into his own hands in a rather unconventional way. He went to the newspaper, and he took out an article. The article read, to the person who stole the tools from my barn, please, if you need money and are close to our farm, offer your labor, offer your time constructively, and I will pay you a decent wage for your services. Not only will your debt be forgiven without penalty, but I will teach you valuable skills you will no doubt find useful in future employment. That's weird. That's not how the world reacts, but that's exactly what the Bible would tell us to do. Paul says in 1 Thessalonians 5, see that no one repays evil for evil, but always seek to do good. In other words, seek the high ground. Take the high road. Be the bigger person. Don't let yourself get pulled down into the mentality of the world that says, get even. Peter says here in verse 9, do not repay evil for evil or reviling for reviling. But notice he says, on the contrary, bless. For to this you were called. You mean I should bless the person who wronged me? You mean I shouldn't go out and try to get even? You mean I should be the bigger person? You mean I should bless this one who brings the storm of suffering into my life? Yes, but not in the way you might be thinking. This doesn't mean that if you go home from church today and you look at your garage door and you notice some person has come along with several cans of spray paint and put a mural on your garage that you stop what you're doing and you say, Lord, what a great, great talent of art. Bless this person and let him continue to do this kind of thing. That's not at all what that means. But what it does mean is that in an indirect way, by not being pulled down to their level, you might actually bring them up to yours. You know, studies actually show that when a person receives grace and mercy and they know they deserve judgment and punishment, they actually feel more guilty about the thing that they've done. You see, they expect you to retaliate and they expect you to come back at them. But when you come back with grace and mercy, what you do is actually emphasize in their mind and in their heart what they've done. You see, when people treat you badly, they're usually looking for a reason to justify it. They're looking to how you're going to respond. And if you come back with evil, if you come back and you treat them badly in return, in their mind, it's perfectly justified because, look, they deserved it anyway. They say they're a Christian, but apparently it doesn't matter. They say they follow Jesus, but I didn't see a whole lot of turning the other cheek, and so they deserve what they got. And their mind, it then makes sense. But when you come back with mercy and blessing, and you come back with grace and forgiveness, what you do is upset that natural desire to justify the act. You see, as people, we're wired to expect an appropriate response. And when you give a disproportionate response to the crime, you give grace when they gave evil, that doesn't compute. And that whole system of thinking starts to shut down. Solomon tells us in Proverbs 25, if your enemy is hungry, give him bread. If your enemy is thirsty, give him water. He says, for you will heap burning coals on his head. Now, back in that time, that was significant because if someone was being shamed for sin, they would walk around the city or even outside the city in some cases with a tray or a pan on their head filled with hot burning coals. And it was the right of the person they offended to actually put the coals in that pan. And so when people saw someone walking around like this, this brought shame onto them and their household because people knew they had sinned. And Peter says here that when you take the high road, you can bring that person's attention to their sin in a way that you couldn't otherwise. And so he says, seek high ground. Second, we stand our ground. Notice what he goes on to say in verse 13. Now, who is there to harm you if you're zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled. You know, most people understand as a general rule, and I understand to every rule there are exceptions, but as a general rule of thumb in life, if you do good, you will avoid problems. If, for example, you consistently drive the speed limit, you are probably not going to get pulled over. You probably won't have a bad encounter with the police. You're probably going to avoid the judge. If you go to work every day and you work hard and you give an honest effort, you're probably going to have a good relationship with your boss and your coworkers. And if you love your spouse and your family, you are probably going to have a happy home. Paul tells us in Galatians 6, whatever one sows, that will he also reap. And so for the most part in life, if you mind your business and live peacefully, and right here as Peter says in verse 13, if you are zealous for good, then probably you won't have too many issues. I heard one person say, if you please God, you will by default please most people. And so when it comes to our life, if we live our life for good and pleasing God, we will probably avoid most issues. But, and this is a big but, there will come a time in your life where that's not true. There will come a time where you've done good, and you've worked hard, and you've taken the high road, and you've lived peacefully, and you've minded your business. You've been zealous for good. You've been pleasing the Lord. You're not looking for trouble, and trouble finds you anyway. That's exactly what happened with Job. You remember Job? You can't think of Job without thinking, poor, poor Job. This was a righteous man. This was a man that just sat around all day. He worshiped the Lord. He made sacrifices to God in case he sinned or his children did. He was a man that God said in Job chapter 1, there is none like him in the earth. And so Job was a man who wasn't looking for trouble. And yet because of his faith and because of his righteous living, he found himself in the middle of the storm of life. It happens. It happens to him. It happens to us. Jesus said in Matthew 5, verse 10, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. And so there will be a time when you've done everything right and the storm still comes. And so the question is, what do we do? Well, the first thing Peter says is you seek high ground. Take the high moral road. Don't get pulled down to their level. But then notice what he says in verse 15. But in your hearts, honor Christ, the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and respect. In other words, be confident in your faith. Seek high ground, but stand your ground. Hold on to that faith. Be assured of what you believe. It's interesting because in verse 15, the phrase he uses for make a defense in Greek, that translates to apologia. And if you've ever heard the phrase Christian apologetics, that's exactly what that's talking about. And even though it may sound like it, it has nothing to do with apologizing. This has nothing to do with being sorry or walking on eggshells. In fact, exactly the opposite. Apologetics means to double down on a defense. And if you wanted to get real technical, what you would say is this is actually a term they used in court. Much the way it is today. If a person was accused of a crime, the prosecution had to come up with an argument for their guilt. They called that the categoria. And that's what they would present to the judge. But then the defense would come up with the apologia, the defense of the person, doubling down on the innocence of the defendant. And so Peter says, as believers, as Christians, as students of the Bible, we should be ready to explain our faith to another person. Because there will come a time when even though you've avoided all the trouble you can avoid, it has found you. And somebody will ask you questions about your faith and even try to make you question what you believe. And you should be able to respond in confidence. This is what I believe. Psalm 66 says, come and hear all you who fear God, and I will tell you what he has done for my soul. You remember the story of Jesus freeing the man that was riddled with demons in Luke chapter 8. He cast the demons out of the man. They go into this herd of pigs, and the pigs kind of go insane. They walk off a cliff. But then after the man was freed from the demons, it says in Luke chapter 8, Jesus sent him away saying, return to your home and declare how much God has done for you. And he went away proclaiming throughout the whole city how much Jesus had done for him. And Peter says every believer should be able to proclaim to others what Jesus has done in their life. Now, this doesn't mean that you have to have all the answers to all the questions and silence all the skeptics and refute all the critics. Some people think this means go argue with unbelievers. That's not what it means. It doesn't mean you'll have all the answers. I can tell you after years of seminary and hundreds of sermons, I have more questions now than I did before. It doesn't take very long for me to tell you, I don't know. I have no idea. But that's not what Peter's talking about. What he's talking about is when it comes to your personal life, why is it that you believe? What has God done for you? Where has he brought you from? What did he free you from? Where are you headed? That you can articulate and explain to somebody, you know, I'm not where I want to be, but by the grace of God, I'm not where I was. And Peter says, whether you call it a testimony, as some do, or a defense, as Peter mentions here, that we're ready to explain to somebody, you know, this is why I believe. I'm standing that ground. I may not have all the answers, but I know what God has done in my life. And so we stand our ground confidently. But notice what else he says in verse 15. He says, yet do it with gentleness and respect. So we stand our ground confidently, but we also do it respectfully. If you've ever walked by a person on the street, and you know exactly what I mean when I say they're screaming at people, and they're yelling at people, and it's the type of street evangelist that goes, if you don't repent, you're going to hell. You've walked by those people. You know, I've never walked by one of those people and thought to myself, you know, I bet I could sit down with this guy and have some coffee. I've never seen somebody like that on the street corner and thought to myself, you know, they seem rational. They seem practical. They seem down to earth. No, I'm kind of hiding my eyes, going, just no eye contact. Keep going. Get out of here. And I'm a pastor. I don't want any part of that. And you know, that's the most common response of people in the world. There was a study done in the UK that found 59% of people, when confronted with that kind of sharing, felt the same way. They were actually less likely to consider Christianity as a faith. They were less likely to believe the Bible. They had a poorer view of believers on average. And that's a problem. Because the gospel message is attractive. The gospel message is not designed to push people away. It's designed to bring them close. Paul tells us in Romans that faith comes through hearing, and hearing the word of Christ. And so the word itself does not push people away. If it did, the church would have died out years ago. The reformers would have never stuck to their guns. The early believers would have never professed Christ, even going to their death. There is something powerful in the gospel message. And so if it isn't the message, then the only other explanation is the messenger. Is it possible in some cases, and I know not all, but in some cases, that messenger is not acting with gentleness? Is it possible that messenger is not acting with respectfulness, that instead they're obnoxious, they're rude and pushy and in your face, and they get in your way? If you're looking for an example of how to share your faith in confidence, but also respectfully, I would say read the story of Jesus ministering to the woman by the well in John chapter 4. You know, she, by all accounts, was one of the least likely people to receive that message. She already distrusted the Jews. She knew their message and didn't believe it. She was an outcast from her own culture. Here Jesus shows up and she wasn't ready for that kind of discussion. He's just kind of by this well, and they're talking, and she's by all accounts one of the most difficult targets for evangelism. And yet after that conversation is over, it says in John 4, and the woman left her water jar and went away into the town and said to the people, come and see a man who told me all I ever did. You see, Jesus didn't yell at that woman. He didn't insult that woman. He didn't belittle that woman. He treated her with gentleness and respect, the same as you would anyone else. And so when it comes to how we respond in the midst of the storm, remember, we seek high ground. We don't let the unbelief of the world pull us down. Second, we stand our ground. We do it confidently. We're ready to share what it is God has done in our life, but we do it respectfully, even to the person bringing the storm. And third, as we close, we sanctify our ground. Notice in verse 18, Peter writes this. For Christ also suffered once for sin, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit, in which he went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison, because they formerly did not obey when God's patience waited in the days of Noah while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is eight persons, were brought safely through water. Baptism, which corresponds to this, now saves you not as a removal of dirt from the body, but as an appeal to God for a good conscience through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who has gone into heaven and is at the right hand of God, with angels, authorities, and powers having been subjected to him. If you go back to verse 18, there's a very interesting word there. It says, also. For Christ also suffered once for sins. And that's an interesting word, because what it does is connect. It connects what Peter said earlier about believers suffering to what he's now saying about Jesus suffering. And so what he's trying to get across to us is that when you face difficulty in life because of your faith, and you're not doing anything to bring this upon yourself, that you're being persecuted for righteousness' sake, and you're living your life in a way that's honoring to God and to people, and the storm still comes, not to dread, because you're dealing with the exact same thing Jesus dealt with. Jesus said in John 15, if the world hates you, know that it hated me before it hated you. And so Peter says, when you walk through storms in life because of your faith, you're walking in the footsteps of Jesus Christ himself. And in that moment, you connect with God at a deeper level, and your path becomes sanctified ground, because Jesus also walked that very path. You know, there's something about hardship connecting people. There's something about going through tough times, even if you don't go through it together, but the fact that you've both been through something similar that connects people at a very deep level. I know any time I've spoken with vets of wars, World War II or Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, you name it. Anytime I've spoken with vets who have been in combat, you notice I notice that they have a bond. It doesn't matter that they were fighting a different war. They're bonded because of that struggle. And when you suffer because of the gospel and you go through storms in life because of your faith, you're bonded with Christ in a way the world won't ever comprehend. And so Peter says here in verse 18, for Christ also suffered once for sin. It's a strange thing to hear this, but sometimes opposition actually means you're going in the right direction. I remember one time as a kid helping my dad fix this car. Now, I'm not mechanically inclined. I don't know the first thing about fixing cars. That's why the Lord gives us mechanics. I don't need to know that stuff. They know that stuff. And so I'm helping my dad, not knowing anything, but he tells me, take this wrench and loosen that bolt. And so I try. But it's not loosening, and I am going the right direction. I know that much, but it's not budging. And he said, that's all right, just give it a little kick. It'll get it started. And so I did, and it got it started. And so I'm wrenching on this bolt, but I tell my dad, you know, it feels a little too easy. I think there's something wrong. And he said, it's all right, just keep going. And I did, and I wrenched it, and I turned, and eventually the wrench popped off, and the bolt came off. And I looked at it, and I said, boy, this looks funny. What had happened was the bolt never moved. The head had twisted off. We spent the next 2 hours drilling out that bolt from that hole. You see, sometimes opposition means you're going in the right direction. A carpenter knows he's cutting in the right direction because the resistance from the board itself. A fisherman knows there's a fish on the hook because it pulls against the pole. And Jesus said in John 16, verse 33, in the world you will have tribulation. So the question isn't if the storm happens, but rather when it happens and you're standing in the middle of it, how does a believer respond? What steps should we be taking when we're standing in the midst of the wind and the rain and the waves are crashing and it's gone from it will happen one day to I'm in the middle of it today? What steps should we be taking? Well, first you seek high ground. Don't let all of that pull you down. Second, you stand your ground. Be confident about what you believe. Don't let this storm shake your belief. You have an unshakable faith in an immovable God, and no storm can rattle that. So you stand your ground. And third, remember, you have sanctified ground. because you're walking in the footsteps of Jesus himself. And when you know what to do and you have some steps to follow, it doesn't matter what storm the world throws at you. You can walk through it with confidence.